One of the interesting paradoxes about life is that in one sense, we could say some things never change, right? So we can all think of things that seem to be timeless. And, you know, Solomon could say there is nothing new under the sun. In some ways, the things that we see today are things that people have experienced in any generation, I suppose, since the very first people ever walked the planet that God made. But in another way, we could also say with just as much truthfulness that things are always changing. So it just depends on how we look at it. But sometimes it seems that no matter what, things just continually change and circumstances change and times change. So that, you know, if you've lived to be any age at all, you have to start fighting the urge to say, when I was a kid, you know, and it's already happened to me that, you know, I know people get, probably young people get tired of hearing that, but I remember when, and well, back when I was a kid. And so I was even thinking about some of those things. How many of you remember this? I remember driving to Huntsville when Huntsville didn't start until about where UAH is. And from Athens, I mean, going down 72. And Mom said, look, Eric. And there was these big trucks, I mean, the big tractors, and they were leveling the ground out there. And it was in the middle of nowhere. And I said, she said, they're building a mall. And I was like, I remember wondering, why are they building a mall out here in the middle of nowhere? Because it was, if you remember, in a huge field, there was nothing there. And now that's Madison Square Mall, if you can imagine that, just like that, you're already in Huntsville proper by the time you get there. Here's the, of course, that was 1984, by the way, 30 years ago. And I was born in 74, so that would have been, I would have been about 10 years old when all this was going on. Do you remember the name, there's some fashion, by the way, for you guys. This guy's looking good. I totally forgot this name at all until I was reading some of these stories, but do you remember the name Pizzitz? I had totally even forgotten that existed in a Kastner knot. Everybody remember those kind of places? Those kind of long forgotten, names. But anyway, you know, now you can look back and I can look back and say, I remember when. And things are a lot different, now than they were in those days then. Of course, in a lot of ways fashion and just the way things are going in our country and all those things. And then we wonder, well, what does the future hold for the next generation? If you could go from to 30 years from now, you know, what will you guys be looking back and telling your kids that you remember, and how will it be different when you get to be old? And nobody knows. It might be pretty well about the same. It could be radically better. It might be everybody's in flying cars, and who knows, you know. Or it could be that things, you know, take a turn for the worse. And just that's one of the things. We don't know what the future holds. But as the psalm says, and I appreciate Shannon leading that, I can face uncertain days because he lives. We don't really know what the future holds. But we do know who we believe in, don't we? Well, the reason I bring all this up is because we're in our story in the traveling to Egypt this summer in that series. We've kind of wrapped up Genesis, and we're going to cross over into the book of Exodus. And as we do so, the setting has really, really changed as we go from Genesis to Exodus. And so that's kind of what I want to talk about as we sort of bridge the gap. So we're going to sort of stand with one foot in each book and look at how things changed in Egypt from the close of Genesis to the beginning of Exodus. And then seeing how things had changed, I want to make some applications to our own day and our own country. First of all, at the end of Genesis, it really ends on a very high note, doesn't it? It ends on a great note. I mean, things were looking pretty rough there, but then by the time Joseph and his family worked things out and they moved everybody back, they were given the land of Goshen to live in, and it's like life is good. And it looks like it's all going to be, you know, happy times as far as the eye can see. And there's some reasons why things were going well in Egypt as well. In Egypt, the country was being blessed. And let's look at some reasons why. First of all, we're going to start in Genesis and we'll work our way over to Exodus. But in Genesis 41, Pharaoh recognized the authority of God that was in Joseph. Remember when he had Joseph called to interpret his dream after the cupbearer finally remembered? Well, in verse 37, after Joseph interprets the dream and then proposes this plan to set aside food for the years of famine, we're told this proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? So here is a humble Pharaoh who understands and appreciates that Joseph is only able to interpret this dream in, by the Spirit of God. And therefore, as a result of that, he recognized that Joseph had a wisdom in him and that he would be a good person to be put in, to put in charge. Verse 39, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only in regards to the throne will I be greater than you." So that's very interesting that this was a former slave, and up until about 5 minutes before that, a prisoner. And now Pharaoh has the sense to see that God is working in this man. And therefore, if God's working in him, he's who I want to have in charge because he's got the wisdom of God, and that would be a perfect person to run the show. And so he tells Joseph, "I'm promoting you. You're going to be in charge." And because he recognized the wisdom of God in Joseph. And I'm going somewhere with all this in just a few moments. Not only that, he blessed the people of God. In chapter 45, you'll remember that a lot of this is going to be reviewed for those of us who've been through here through this series. That in chapter 45, verse beginning of verse 16, Pharaoh found out Joseph's brothers have come, and he's really excited. And so he goes to Joseph. He says, "Tell your family to come on down." And not only would he kind of carve out a little space somewhere and make room for them, but he says, they'll have access to the very best of the land. In verse 18, "I will give you the best of the land." Verse 20, "All the best of the land of Egypt is yours." So Pharaoh blessed the people of God as well. And it gave them the best of the land of Egypt. Really kind of going, I would say, wouldn't you agree, above and beyond what was even probably expected. Maybe it would be right for him to allow them to come and find their own way and have some food. But he goes beyond that to saying, "I'm going to give you the very best that we have to offer to your family, Joseph, to because of what you have done." Also, as a result of all this, Egypt, the country, was blessed by God. And we see that in 41, 56 to 57, when the famine was severe over all the earth, there was food there. And people came from all over to buy that food. And as they came to buy food, of course, imagine what's happening. You've got Egypt. They're the only people in the whole part of the world with anything to eat, and it's all for sale. And so when people like Joseph's family load up their goods and make a trip down there to buy food, Egypt is being enriched. Because of the wisdom of God's plan, they're prospering, money's pouring into Egypt, and they've got stuff to eat when everybody else is starving to death. And then, in down in chapter 47, in a passage that we really didn't look at, we're not going to go into depth today even, Joseph very shrewdly uses these food supplies to the advantage of the strength of Pharaoh's rule over the people. Because the people quickly ran out of money. And they said, "Well, we'll give you our lands." He said, "Okay." He bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. And then they ran out of land, and he said, "Well, we'll give you ourselves." He said, "Okay." And so from the beginning to the end of this, the power was kind of consolidated in the house of Pharaoh as he ruled over the people. And I thought this was very interesting. The arrangement he made, well, he didn't really turn them into slaves. They became servants. But what that really meant was they had to pay taxes. Look at verse 23 to 24 or 47. "Joseph said to the people, 'Behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Here's seed for you, and you shall sow the land. At the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and 4/5 shall be your own. As seed for the field, as food for yourselves and your households, as food for your little ones.'" 20%. Jack just got his first job this summer, and he was telling me the other day, man, the government takes a chunk out of that check because he sees it on the stub. And that's one of those things we all have to realize. Now, this goes in the category of things that never change, right? Now, notice here, how much is this federal tax? 20%. So I just got to keep thinking, I wonder how much the net amount that we pay in taxes to the federal government. If you summed it all up, and they do track these things. So I found a site that shows it. The blue line is the total average U.S. federal tax rate. That's if you take all taxes and sum them up and average it out. Isn't that interesting how it hovers around 20%? Red's Egypt in Joseph's day. Blue's us. Starting in, oh, wow, that's kind of zoomed down. But that starts over there in 1980, and it goes in like basically 10-year increments up to 2010. So from 1980 to 2010, the blue line shows that we've hovered around as high as 22%, And as of right, the lowest it got was about 18%. What does all that mean? Nothing. It's just interesting that we pay about 20% to the federal government. In Joseph's day, they paid 20% to the federal government. Now we pay local and state taxes as well, so that total tax burden is probably a little higher than that. But anyway, it's just an interesting thing, I thought, that it just happened to be, because I was curious, do we do more or less than that? And it's about the same as what we do today. So file that under things that never change. Of course, taxes never go away. And that's just part of life, and it was in Joseph's day as well. Now, as the story ends, Egypt is prospering. The people of Israel are prospering. Chapter 47, verse 27. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen. They gained possessions in it, and they were fruitful and multiplied greatly. This is part of God's promise to Abraham. Remember what he said? I will bless you, and your seed, they'll multiply. They'll be like the sands of the seashore, like the stars of the heavens. So this is happening. It's happening here in Egypt. They're sort of supernaturally fertile, we might say. So that they're really, more so, the feeling I get is more so than everybody else, they're really, really, really having lots of kids. And so they're multiplying and growing in the land. They're being blessed. Egypt's being blessed. And let's just read the last two verses of the book to get the kind of the note that it ends on. Chapter 50, verses 25 and 26. Jacob has died. Joseph's about to die. Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And that's how Genesis ends. And so it seems like all is going well, right? And so this might be the time we have a little intermission, and everybody goes and gets your popcorn, and, you know, we wait, because we've got like the second half of the book or the movie or whatever, the musical is coming, that we've got this intermission now in between. The curtain closes at the end of Genesis. Now, after everybody gets to see back down, they blink the lights and all that, the curtain rolls back and we open up into Exodus chapter 1. Is the scene different? The scene is very different. We're still in the same location, right? Still the same people. We still have Egyptians and the Israelites. We have a Pharaoh. But a lot of things have changed from Genesis 50 to Exodus chapter 1. So let's look at how some things have changed. First of all, Exodus begins with a summary. The first seven verses kind of wrap up the way Genesis left off. It kind of just kind of reminds us that it goes through who all had moved down to Egypt, the list of the brothers of Joseph. And then verse 6 says, then Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. Kind of a sad thing to me. I remember feeling this way when we studied the life of David for a long time in class, and it's kind of like you sort of become attached to these people after you've been studying them for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then when you get to the point where they die, you almost feel sad, you know, even though they've been dead for a long time. We've been talking about Joseph and his brothers and his dad and following the drama of their family, and then there came a point where they were all gone. But, you know, generations do that, don't they? In fact, you know, we could think about the generation that lived through the Great Depression, and many of you, you know, maybe some of you experienced that. Many of you knew people that did. I remember my grandparents, my grandfather, who died a few years ago, and he was in his upper 80s, was a little boy at that time, but he told me stories about all that, you know, what he experienced and all that. And he fought in World War II. That generation is passing away. And in fact, there was a story, and these seem like they come up, you know, like this past year, it was the 70th anniversary of some veterans assembly that these guys had discovered a U-boat submarine or something. But anyway, they announced in the news this would be the last time they would meet because their numbers had dwindled down so low. There was just a few of them, and they knew they wouldn't be having another meeting because basically that, you know, one generation replaces another. And that's just the way this life is. And here, the generation of Joseph and his brothers is gone. But there's a lot more than one generation that has passed here. In fact, you can't really tell it by this chapter in Exodus, but there's a huge gap in time. Because we found out back in Genesis 15, 13, God said to Abraham, I will lead your people down and they will be slaves for 400 years. And at the end of, when they leave in Exodus 12, verse 40, it says the total time they were in Egypt was 430 years. And so they're going to spend a total of 400 years in Egypt from when Joseph led them down there to when Moses leads them out. Now, Moses hasn't been born yet when Exodus opens. He's about to be. And he's going to be, does anybody remember how old he was when he led them out? 80 years old. And so we still got 80 years of that 400 years that's going to take place here at the beginning of Exodus. And so we're probably 300 or so years into the story when Exodus opens. They've been in Egypt for 300 years. But think about how long that is. Today's 2014. If you backed up 300 years, George Washington had not yet been born. So that's the kind of time span we're talking about. A long time that has passed between during that intermission while the curtain was closed before it opened. 300 years have gone by and we know very, very little about what had taken place other than verse 7 tells us that they had continued to multiply. And it says the children of Israel, or the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong. So the land was filled with them. So when the curtain closed, there were, you know, 70 original, plus they had multiplied over those years that Joseph was alive, a pretty good sized clan. When the curtain opens again in Exodus, everywhere you look, there's children of Israel because they had increased so rapidly during those centuries in between. So the land's full of them. In fact, when Moses leads them out, it's estimated there's about 2 million. So that's the population explosion that's gone on here in that intermission. They had grown from, you know, in the maybe hundreds to in the millions during the time. Those are the good things, but some bad things that happened as well. We're told in verse 8 of Exodus 1, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Of course, it had been a long time since any king had known Joseph, because Joseph had been dead for hundreds of years. But probably what it means is he didn't know and didn't appreciate Joseph and the special relationship that Joseph had had with Pharaoh, what Joseph had done, and the reason why they favored the Jewish people. He didn't know that. There came along a king who didn't care about any of that history. And so now, instead of the Israelites being favored among the Egyptians, he becomes afraid of them. In verses 9 and 10, it says, he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel, too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Which hints at the idea that somewhere during these intervening years, they had become servants to the Egyptians. Maybe they had been all along. I wasn't really sure about that. In fact, do you remember when Joseph wanted to go bury his dad? He had to first get permission to go from Pharaoh, and he was going to go and he'd be right back. Because it seems that Joseph really was, even though he was number two in authority, he wasn't really totally free in the sense of that. He was still a servant of Pharaoh, and his people were probably servants for most of this history. But now it's going to get a lot worse because they're afraid of him. So the king says, there's too many of these people and they might escape and they might even turn on us. And he sort of, it seems like he's at a crossroads, sort of like Rehoboam was in the day of the last of the United Kingdom. Remember that Rehoboam was given two options. You can either be kind to the people and they'll love you and kind of loosen up a little bit. And the young people said, they haven't seen nothing yet. You just, you know, double down on them. And that's exactly what this Pharaoh does. He could have blessed the people of God and they probably would have been, you know, faithful servants to him. But instead, he says, I know what we're going to do. We're going to crack down on them. Beginning verse 11, it says, therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So this picture, as the curtain opens in Exodus 1, is very different as far as how God's people are faring. And it's a sad picture. Instead of being just shepherds who are living there among the land, they're slaves. They're having to work and being treated very harshly. Of course, this is about as far as we're going to go. The one last thing they do, since this didn't hamper them, cracking the whip on them didn't slow them down. And in fact, they multiplied even more. Pharaoh has to take a drastic step and try to stop their population growth. And you remember that he orders in verse 22 that any of the male sons be thrown into the Nile. And so that's about as far as we're going to go with our story in Exodus, because we're really just trying to introduce it. But it looks like as the curtains have opened here in Exodus 1, times are really bad for the Israelites. They're slaves. They're being treated very cruelly. And now their male children are going to be killed. It looks like they're doomed, doesn't it? But we know what's coming. And that's the good part. And it looks like Egypt's going just strong, but we know what's coming for them too, don't we? Dark days are ahead for Egypt. Think of all that, what in the next dozen chapters, how much the Egyptians are going to suffer and be humiliated and lose over what we're about to get into that we won't get into today. But just think about what the future holds that the rest of this book's going to tell us about for them and for God's people. That's all yet to come. But as it opens, it's kind of like there's this storm clouds on the horizon here as the people of Israel are being treated very cruelly. So that's how things have changed from Genesis 50 to Exodus 1. Now I want to make some applications about that to our own day. And this is something, even as I typed it, I thought, it feels really strange to put on a PowerPoint because I don't normally talk about the United States of America and American history and those kinds of things. So in that way, this lesson will be a little bit different than just about all my other lessons because I want to think for a moment about how things have changed in our own country. Not to make any kind of political point or that kind of thing, but to make a point about how we as God's people live and the days that we face that are probably coming on us. So one thing that probably everybody kind of knows, but maybe we don't fully appreciate, is that this country was built on Christian principles and a belief in God and the Bible as His Word. Now, not to say that every one of the founding fathers and everybody that came here were Bible-believing Christians. That would be oversimplifying. That's never been true. But a huge number of our founding fathers had a very vocal faith in God and in the Bible. Let me just give you some examples. By the way, I found these on this website, but I found several places. If you want to read more about it, I can send you a link to this, or you can just Google it. That's what I did, and I found lots and lots and lots of information about what some of these famous quotes that show the faith that some of our, what we call the founding fathers had. So from George Washington, which said, "It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, to humbly implore His protection and favor." But I really liked, and I had never seen this one before, this is a prayer from George Washington. "O eternal and everlasting God, direct my thoughts, words, and work. Wash away my sins in the immaculate blood of the Lamb, and purge my heart by Thy Holy Spirit. Daily frame me more and more in the likeness of Thy Son, Jesus Christ, that living in Thy fear and dying in Thy favor, I may in Thy appointed time obtain the resurrection of the justified unto eternal life. Bless, O Lord, the whole race of mankind, and let the world be filled with the knowledge of Thee and Thy Son, Jesus Christ." That's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, you could pray that, couldn't you, today? So that's George Washington. This man right here is John Adams, and John Adams was the first vice president. He was also a president himself, and he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. So one of the founding fathers. Here's a statement that he made. "The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I believe, that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God." He also said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." That is on display. But basically, the Constitution, this government, what? Of the people, for the people, by the people, whichever order it is it only functions properly when the people who make up the government are morally guided people. Because what happens if they're not? It begins to break down, right? And that's exactly that's what John Adams is saying. This man is, I don't have it on there. That is John Jay, the first Supreme Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said, "The Bible is the best of all books, for it is the Word of God and teaches us the way to be happy in this world and the next. Continue, therefore, to read it and to regulate your life by its precepts." The first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Pretty powerful. This man is Noah Webster. He was called the Schoolmaster of the Republic. Yes, that same Webster. His name is sort of synonymous with dictionaries. Notice what Mr. Noah Webster said. "In my view, the Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things in which all children under a free government ought to be instructed. No truth is more evident to my mind than that the Christian religion must be the basis of any government intended to secure the rights and privileges of a free people. Pretty powerful. We could go on and on. Finally, I have some here that I just had to call out because it's just too many. Here's one from Abraham Lincoln, coming a little closer to present time. In regards to this great book, referring to the Bible, I have but to say it is the best gift God has given to man. All the good the Savior gave to the world was communicated through this book. But for it, we could not know right from wrong. All things most desirable for man's welfare here and hereafter are found portrayed in it. That's our President Lincoln. Now, we come into the 20th century. Do we have some God-fearing presidents? Definitely. We still have some. But here's Ike. Eisenhower said, without God, there could be no American form of government, nor an American way of life. Recognition of the scriptural being as the first, the most basic expression of Americanism. Thus, the founding fathers of America saw it, and thus, with God's help, it will continue to be. He understood the foundation that the country was based on, and he was hoping that would continue to be the foundation we would rest on in the future. Coming on, even up on to about the time the, Madison Square Mall is being built, we have President Reagan, and he said a lot of things that we could quote, but he said, can we resolve to reach, learn, and try to heed the greatest message ever written, God's Word and the Holy Bible? Inside its pages lie all the answers to all the problems that man has ever known. Now, were every one of these people God-fearing New Testament Christians as we understand? I wouldn't say that. But they shared, at least in their speeches and things, if we give them the benefit of the doubt that they meant it, which I think we should, they shared in this common faith in the God, in the existence of the God of the Bible, in the wisdom from His Word, and that is the must be the foundation upon which our country functions if it's going to last and then have freedom, all the way up until pretty recently. As a result of that, I would suggest to you that we have been blessed by God. I thought I had these passages on here, but I don't. Psalm 33:12 said, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people from whom He has chosen as His heritage. And Proverbs 14:34 says, righteousness exalts a nation, and sin is a reproach to any people. So I believe that probably, I don't know that you could prove this, but I believe that because our founding fathers decided to build a whole nation on the Bible and on God and faith in Him, that's probably one of the main reasons why we have been as prosperous and as blessed as we have been. Because they sought as a whole people to try to build a nation based on the principles laid out in the Bible. Now, to be fair, there were, you know, some of the, you probably will hear this if you stay in school, some of them, like Thomas Jefferson, were deists. They didn't all necessarily see the Bible as inspired by God. So it's again, I don't want to oversimplify the picture. But clearly, I think we can say with confidence that the majority of the people who built the country and many of our great leaders have been people who put their faith and trust in the Bible. Now, how have things changed? Let's just think about it. The Bible in school, think about what Noah Webster said. Now, you might be pleased to know, we haven't just completely turned around. It was interesting to know that at Fable High School, you could take a class on the Bible. It's pretty neat, you know. But it's studied as a work of literature. You can study it to, you know, to talk about what it means. Obviously, it's an important document to our country. But as far as like laying out the truth about where we all came from, that part of it's long gone. In the sciences, evolution has ruled the day for decades. Nobody anymore is teaching the Bible's version of the origin of man, the origin of our planet. And I don't believe anybody would be able to even teach that we ought to all be following the Bible as our guide for how to live. That would probably be, a teacher probably would not be allowed to teach that. You can discuss it as a work of literature, but you can't discuss it as in saying this is how all of you kids should live your lives if you want to be happy. Follow this book. I don't think anybody would be able to do that. President Obama, and interestingly, you know, a lot of people believe, even some of my family members, we talk about this, they believe he's secretly a Muslim or something like that because he spent some of his formative years in Indonesia. But if you ask him, he professes to be a Christian, and he has gone to various, church assemblies throughout his, you know, public days in office and all that. So I don't know. But I read this pretty long interview with him where he's describing his religious beliefs. And in it, he basically said he thinks kind of all religions are basically have some truth in them and they're all kind of going the same way. He's not sure if there's a heaven. He thinks maybe we're just blessed now if we do what, you know, we follow the wisdom in scriptures. He doesn't believe there's a hell where people who don't believe in Jesus are going. So if he's a Christian, it's a weird sort of thing. You know, he definitely doesn't believe the core principles of what Jesus taught. And also, he is first and foremost the biggest abortion advocate we've ever had in the White House. In fact, he was kind of on the extreme end of that issue in his days as a senator, even in his days, as senator from Illinois, and continues to push for that. Not just to say it is a right that the courts have given Americans, and as a president, I have to kind of uphold that. But he's sort of pushing the boundaries on it so that you see that, for instance, in some of the Obamacare provisions, in some of these debates that have come up lately about whether you have to force people to provide these morning after pills and all those kinds of things, that he's pushing that as what he calls the freedom of women to pursue their dreams. Instead, even Bill Clinton said it's kind of a necessary thing, but it needs to be hopefully limited and you know, hopefully, you know, he didn't want it to really proliferate. But President Obama seems to be pushing that as a good thing. So he doesn't stand for the morals of the Bible or basic tenets of the Bible. So that's just a change. What you hear him saying is very much different than what we've probably seen in some of the quotes I showed you earlier. There's a general moral decline that we notice around us. I think everybody can see that. You know, you could talk for an hour about that easily. Not only just in our culture, but I think you could see that even in churches now embracing immorality. As far as mainline, mainstream, not just kind of fringe groups, but main denominations really wrestling with, should we have preachers who are openly homosexual, clergymen and those kind of people who you know, have domestic partnerships and performing those kinds of weddings, not just some kind of weird group off in a corner somewhere, but regular big name, you know, like the Presbyterian USA denomination and groups like that who are embracing immorality. So we see all these changes happening and it gives us a lot of concern that just like in the 300 years from the end of Genesis to the beginning of Exodus, look at what's happened since the, you know, Washington's day to today. And what does that mean? Well, let me give you some possibilities. It might be that dark times are ahead for Christians today as well, just like they were for the people of Israel in the beginning of Exodus. And Peter says, if that comes, don't be surprised. Beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you're insulted for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory of God rests upon you. At the end of Genesis, the people of God were blessed and favored in the land of Egypt. In the beginning of Exodus, they were looked down on and persecuted. And it could be, I don't know, like I said at the beginning, nobody knows what the future holds. It could be that we're going to enter into a time when the people of God will be persecuted in this land. And if it happens, it's nothing strange. Actually, what's strange is the period of time we've lived in where the people of God have been pretty well embraced and you know, as normal. That in world history is actually the exception to the rule. The rule has always been that when you follow Jesus, you face persecution for it. And if we do that, we need to be ready and understand and embrace it and rejoice that we're doing nothing more than following in the footsteps of many before us who had to suffer for their faith. And that's not unaccepted or unexpected, you know, is what I mean to say. It's also possible that just like God was about to humble Egypt, that the favored status that our nation seems to have enjoyed for 200 years is also in jeopardy. Daniel 4:17, there's this great statement there that as it replied to Nebuchadnezzar, to the end that the living might know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over the lowliest of men. I believe God's still in control of what's going on. I don't really know how he does all that. That's an interesting question about how, you know, powers come and go. But could it be that if America continues to embrace immorality and turn away from God, that there's going to be a consequence to that, that our own country will decline as a result of that and be humbled like the Egyptians are about to be humbled in our story in Exodus? I think it's possible that could happen for us as well. But if these dark times are ahead, and that is a little depressing to think about. But here's something encouraging, because I know sometimes the kids feel like, well, I kind of hear gloom and doom everywhere. You know, I got teachers there telling them and all these things, you know, the economy's in the pits and, you know, politically, it just seems like everybody everywhere is saying, boo, you know, it's all bad news all the time. And that's, you know, that can be discouraging. But here's the encouraging part, that as we read and we continue to study in Exodus, God's people, God's always had people who were faithful even under those circumstances, and God watches them and he knows what's going on. And skipping ahead one chapter to the end of chapter 2 in Exodus, here's how chapter 2 ends. During the days, the many days, the king of Egypt died. During those many days, the king of Egypt died. And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery, and they cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Because God knows, and he watches, and the Lord sees us. And so if it is true, or if it happened to be, that we face dark days, or our children do, we can, as the song we sang right before, as we hold our newborn baby and all that, and we think about what's coming, we can face uncertain days because he lives. So whatever the future holds, we have our faith in a God who is powerful and who is watching us and who will bless us and who's given us promises and a hope that will see us through all of that. And in the end, we know he's going to rescue us and we know he's going to take us home. So whatever comes, we can still maintain our optimism about how the story ends, because we know who's going to be victorious in the end. It's God and his people. And that's just, you know, something that we can take comfort in. And we can remember that we are citizens of the kingdom. That was already mentioned before. I believe Mickey might even mention it in his prayer. Hebrews 12, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. This hope that we have of being taken home with the Lord and knowing that the story has a happy ending is a benefit and a blessing that belongs to children of God. That's who God's looking. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. His ears are open to their prayer. This morning, if you're living right with God, then you can rest easy